The last thing Nora expected, on the morning she finally stopped running, was to see his face again. She had rehearsed this moment 100 times in the 3 years since she had fled Ashenvale with nothing but a wool cloak, cracked boots, and the terrible secret she carried beneath her ribs like a stone. She had imagined what she would feel. Rage, perhaps, or the hollow numbness that had become her closest companion. She had not imagined that her hands would simply go still, that the bread she was slicing for the children would stop mid-motion, that the kitchen air would thicken around her the way it always did before something irreversible happened. She had not imagined she would feel afraid. Not of him. Never of him. Not exactly. Of what his presence meant. Of what it would unravel. Nora set the knife down carefully and looked out through the narrow window above the bakery counter. The village square of Crestholm was draped in silver and white. Banners strung between the old stone buildings. Garlands of dried winter flowers hanging from every post. The wedding procession had been expected since dawn. She had known it was coming. Every soul in the 4 surrounding territories had known. The Alpha King is to be married today. She had told herself it did not matter. She had told herself this for 6 weeks, ever since the herald's announcement had reached even this remote mountain village, and she had felt the words land in her chest like a blade, finding the exact right seam. It did not matter. She had a life here. 3 years of silence, of bread making and herb drying and quiet mornings that belonged entirely to her. 3 years of proving to herself that she could build something from wreckage. She turned from the window. The 3 of them were at the long table near the hearth. Oliver, the oldest by 4 minutes, dark-haired and serious-eyed, pressing shapes into a piece of dough with focused concentration. Beside him, Ilara, the middle child, was attempting to balance a wooden spoon on her finger and had already knocked over a small jar of cinnamon. And curled against the corner of the bench, half asleep despite the noise, was little Seth, his pale hair fanned against the wood, his mouth slightly open, 3 years old, all 3 of them. Born in the dead of winter, in a borrowed room above a cobbler's shop in a town that had never heard the name Ashenvale. Nora breathed. She needed to finish the bread. She needed to get through this day, the way she had gotten through every other day, by moving forward, one task at a time, without looking back at the shape of everything she had lost. She picked up the knife again. That was when the bells began. Not the soft chapel bells that marked the ceremony hours. These were the great iron bells of the square, rung only for arrivals of highest rank. The sound rolled through the stone walls of the bakery and settled in her bones, and Nora stood motionless as the vibration passed through her. She heard horses. Many horses. The low resonance of a crowd pulling toward silence the way crowds did when power moved through them. "Do not look," she told herself. She looked. Through the small, frost-edged window, she saw the procession enter the square. Ashenvale's royal guard in their black and iron livery, 2 columns of them, forming a corridor through the gathered villagers. The white carriage carrying the bride. She could see the pale silk through the carriage window. A woman she did not recognize, young and composed and utterly unaware of what this day was costing the woman watching from a bakery window 40 feet away. And then, at the head of the procession, on a black horse that moved like dark water, him. Aiden. He was exactly as she remembered and entirely different. The 3 years that had softened her, worn her down to something quieter and more careful, had done nothing of the sort to him. He sat straight in the saddle, broad-shouldered beneath his formal black armor, a silver clasp at his collar bearing the wolf crest of Ashenvale. His dark hair, still worn long, caught the winter light. His jaw was harder than she remembered. His eyes, even from this distance, even through wavy glass, were the same pale gray she had spent 3 years trying to forget. He was scanning the crowd, not with the distracted survey of a man playing his ceremonial role. He was looking. Actually looking, with that particular stillness he had, the quality of attention that had once made her feel like the only person in any room. Nora stepped back from the window. Her heel caught the edge of a basket, and she stumbled, catching herself against the counter with both hands. And the small sound she made was enough to wake Seth, who lifted his head from the bench with heavy eyes. Mama? It's nothing. Her voice came out even. 3 years of practice. Go back to sleep, little one. He obeyed, because Seth had always been trusting in a way that sometimes broke her heart. Nora pressed her palms flat on the counter and breathed slowly. She needed to think. The procession would pass through the square and continue to the great hall at the village's northern edge, where the ceremony was to be held. Crestholm had been chosen for the wedding because it was neutral territory. Not Ashenvale's stronghold, not any rival pack's land, but a border village that owed formal allegiance to the Alpha King's Council, and nothing more. A political gesture dressed in flowers. She needed only to stay inside. The bakery had a back entrance. She could take the children through the herb garden, into the narrow lane behind, and wait at Marta's house until the procession had passed. Marta was the village healer, an elderly woman who asked no questions and made very good tea. She had been Nora's anchor in this place since the beginning. "That is what you will do," Nora told herself. "You will take them and go." She was already moving toward the inner door when Oliver looked up from his dough shapes. "There are horses," he said, with the calm certainty of a child who noticed everything. "Yes. Big ones. I can hear them." "Come with me," Nora said quietly. "Both of you. We're going to Marta's." Alara slid off the bench immediately, cinnamon dusted and cheerful, taking it as an adventure. Oliver studied his mother's face with those old, careful eyes of his and said nothing more. He wiped his hands on his apron. She had made him a small apron because he had asked for one, and stood. She had just lifted Seth from the bench, still warm with sleep and heavy against her shoulder, when the bakery door opened. Not the front door. The front door was bolted. She had bolted it at dawn when she first heard the announcement bells, some instinct she hadn't examined making her throw the iron latch without thinking. The side door, the one that faced the alley. She turned. It was not Aiden. It was a woman she did not recognize. Middle-aged, wearing the plain gray wool of a council attendant, her expression carefully neutral in the way of someone who had been trained to deliver information without reaction. "Nora Vile," the woman said. Nora's chest contracted. 3 years. She had not heard her own name spoken aloud in 3 years. Here, she was simply Nora, the baker's assistant. Nora who made the dark bread with the caraway seeds. "You have the wrong person," Nora said. The woman's eyes moved to the three children with the quiet efficiency of someone completing a task. She took in Oliver's dark hair, the exact shade and texture of Ashenvale's royal line. She took in Seth's pale gray eyes, eyes that matched precisely the ones Nora had just seen through the frost-edged window. She took in Alara's jawline, the particular angle of it, familiar to anyone who had ever looked at a portrait of the Ashenvale bloodline. The woman looked back at Nora. "His Majesty has seen you," she said simply. "He asks that you remain. The bread in the oven would burn." It was the only thought Nora's mind produced for a full 3 seconds, that the bread would burn, that she had worked all morning on it, that it was the honey rye that old Peter always bought on festival days, and now it was going to char. Then Seth stirred against her shoulder and pressed his small face into her neck, and the ordinary thought dissolved, and what replaced it was very clear and very cold. He saw them. 3 years of careful distance. 3 years of a different name in a different village, in a different corner of the world. 3 years of building walls around the truth so that it could not reach back and destroy what she had made. And in the span of one moment, through a frost-edged window, it had all come apart. Nora looked at her children. Oliver was watching her with that grave, attentive expression that always reminded her that he understood more than he should. Alara had taken his hand, sensing the shift in the room's air. Seth was awake now, looking at the strange woman with open curiosity. Nora straightened her spine. She had run once, in the dark, with nothing, when she had no other choice. She had been 22 years old, and bleeding, and certain she was going to lose everything. And she had lost it anyway, just in a different order than she'd feared. She was not 22 anymore. "Tell him," Nora said, her voice low and entirely steady, "that I don't take orders from kings." The attendant's expression did not change. "He anticipated that response," she said. "He also said to tell you..." She paused, as if reciting something memorized with care. "That he knows now what he didn't know then, and that he is asking, not commanding." The silence in the bakery was absolute except for the distant sound of bells, and the muffled crowd, and the soft crackling of the oven fire. Nora looked at the door, looked at her children, looked at the attendant, and felt, with awful clarity, that the walls she had built were already gone. She did not go to him immediately. That was the one small act of will she allowed herself. The refusal to move the moment she was summoned, as though she were still the obedient young woman who had stood in Ashenvale's great hall 3 years ago, in a dress that didn't quite fit, waiting to be told what her life would look like. She was not that woman anymore. First, she took the bread out of the oven. It was slightly darker at the edges than she would have liked, but it had not burned. She set it on the cooling rack with deliberate care, while the attendant waited near the side door in perfect silence. Then she poured water into the clay cups and made the children drink. She smoothed Alara's hair back from her face and retied the ribbon that was always coming loose. She straightened Seth's collar and crouched in front of Oliver, who was watching her with those unreadable gray eyes. "Are we in trouble?" he asked quietly. "No." She held his gaze. "We are never in trouble. Do you understand me? Whatever happens today, we are not in trouble. We have done nothing wrong." Oliver considered this with the gravity of a child who took words seriously. Then he nodded. Nora stood. She unfolded her apron, folded it neatly over the back of the chair, and reached for her wool cloak on the hook by the door. Gray, worn at the hem, thoroughly ordinary. She pulled it around her shoulders and fastened the clasp at her throat. "Lead the way," she said to the attendant. They did not go through the square. The attendant guided them through the network of narrow lanes behind the bakery, away from the crowd and the banners and the silver-white decorations, through a gate in a stone wall that Nora had never noticed in 3 years of living here, and into the enclosed courtyard behind Crestholm's council hall. It was a quiet space, a well at the center, a few bare-branched trees, the smell of cold stone and old moss. Two guards stood at the far entrance. They stepped aside without being asked. Nora kept Oliver's hand in her left, and Seth's in her right. Alara walked pressed against her side, one hand curled in the fabric of her cloak, unusually quiet. Children understood atmosphere in ways adults forgot they could. The attendant stopped at an arched doorway and turned. "He is inside, alone." "The ceremony," Nora said, "has been postponed." A pause. "Temporarily." Nora absorbed this. The Alpha King of Ashenvale had stopped his own wedding. The political implications of that were staggering. She knew enough of pack law and council protocol to understand that postponing a formal alliance ceremony was not a small thing. It would be read as instability. It would give every rival pack in the surrounding territories something to discuss for months. He had done it anyway. She did not know what to do with that information, so she set it aside and walked through the doorway. The room was a council antechamber. Long wooden table, high-backed chairs, a fireplace with a modest fire, maps rolled and stacked against the wall. The smell of pine resin and old parchment, and beneath it, something she recognized before her mind had time to name it. Something that belonged entirely to memory. to a version of her life she had sealed away and buried. Aiden was standing at the window. He turned when she entered, and for a moment, neither of them moved. He looked different in the way that mattered. Not older, not harder. She had already registered those things from a distance. Different in the way his face changed when he saw her. She had expected many things from him. The cool authority he wore publicly like a second armor. The careful blankness of a man who had learned to show nothing to anyone. She had not expected what she saw instead, which was something closer to fracture. Something that crossed his features, and then was controlled, but not before she had seen it. His eyes moved to the children. He went very still. Oliver, Seth, Ilara. He looked at each of them in turn with the focused, absorbing attention of someone trying to hold a great many things together at once. His jaw tightened. His hands, at his sides, were motionless, but she could see the tension in them from across the room. Then he looked at her. Nora. His voice was low. It had always been low. It had always carried in a way that other voices didn't. Your Majesty. The title came out cooler than she intended, or perhaps exactly as cool as she intended. She was no longer sure of the difference. Something shifted in his expression. He crossed the room in measured strides and stopped several feet away, close enough to speak without raising his voice, far enough that she understood he was not going to crowd her. She noted this. She did not let it mean anything yet. "Thank you for coming," he said. "I wasn't given a great deal of choice." "You were." He said it simply, without defense. "My attendant had instructions to withdraw if you refused." "I meant what I said." "I was asking." Nora studied him. 3 years had a way of sharpening the eye. She had spent those years reading people carefully. The village healer who might ask too many questions. The traveling merchants who sometimes worked as information brokers for distant packs. The wandering council scouts who occasionally passed through border villages looking for persons of interest. She had become very good at reading intention. She could not read him the way she once thought she could. That was the problem. That had always been the problem. "What do you want, Aiden?" She used his name deliberately, without the title, because she was not his subject anymore. She had signed no formal papers, but she had walked out of Ashenvale 3 years ago and not looked back. And that was its own kind of severance. His gaze moved to the children again. "I want to understand what I'm looking at." "You're looking at my children." "Yes." A pause. "Are they also mine?" The room was very quiet. The fire crackled softly. Outside, somewhere in the distance, she could hear the faint sound of the crowd in the square, still waiting, not yet understanding why the procession had halted. Nora had prepared for this question. She had prepared for it for 3 years, in the theoretical, far-off way that one prepares for catastrophes, one hopes will never arrive. She had composed answers in her head in the small hours of the morning, when the children were asleep, and the silence left too much room for thought. Careful, measured answers that would give away nothing essential. All of those answers left her now. "Why didn't you tell me?" she asked instead. "About Seraphine." The name landed like a stone in still water. She watched the ripples move across his face. Not guilt, exactly, but something adjacent to it. Recognition. The particular expression of someone who has been waiting for a specific blow and is relieved in a grim way to finally receive it. "Seraphine was your arranged companion. I know." Nora's voice was steady. She had worked very hard on keeping it steady. "I found out the night before I left. I found the council's correspondence. The agreement between your advisors and her family, signed before our alliance was formalized, before I ever set foot in Ashenvale." She paused. "You were going to honor it." "It was complicated." It was a choice. She said it without venom, simply as fact. You were going to honor an agreement that made our arrangement a political convenience, and no one told me. Not you, not your council, not one person in that entire stronghold who I thought... She stopped, steadied. I was 22 years old. I was in a place where I knew no one. I had given up everything my family had left me in order to build something in Ashenvale. And the night I found out, I also realized I was carrying 3 children I had no idea how to tell you about. So I left. Silence. Aiden said nothing for a long moment. His face had gone very still in the way it did when he was holding something in with great effort. The correspondence you found, he said at last, was from my former counsel. Advisors who acted without my knowledge or sanction. Seraphine's family approached them directly. The agreement was never ratified by me. I dissolved it when I found out, 3 weeks after you disappeared. He looked at her steadily. I have spent 3 years looking for you. Nora's chest did something she refused to acknowledge. She kept her expression even. That is a convenient thing to say now. Yes. He didn't argue it. It is, and you have no reason to believe it. I understand that. He glanced again at the children. Oliver, who had been watching this exchange with careful attention, and Alara, who had discovered a loose thread on her cloak and was pulling it, and Seth, who had fallen asleep, standing up against Nora's side in the miraculous way that very small children could. But I need to know. Please. The please was unexpected. She had never heard him use it like that, stripped of ceremony, without the weight of rank behind it. Just the word, plain and exposed. Nora looked at her children. She thought about what it had cost her to keep this secret. Not just the fear and the loneliness, but the smaller daily erosions. The way Oliver sometimes asked about his father, with the careful restraint of a child who sensed the question was difficult. The way she had learned to answer around the edges of the truth without quite lying. The way it had worn a particular groove of guilt into her chest that she had grown so accustomed to, she no longer noticed it most of the time. Yes, she said quietly. They are yours. She heard him exhale. It was not a dramatic sound. It was the kind of exhale that happens when a person has been holding something for a very long time and finally sets it down. He closed his eyes briefly, and when he opened them again, something in his face had rearranged itself. Not softened, exactly, but settled. Like a map that has finally been oriented correctly. Their names, he said. Oliver. Alara. Seth. He repeated them quietly, as though testing the weight of each one. Then he looked at her again. And this time, the careful maintained distance in his expression was gone. What replaced it was something rawer and more difficult and far more dangerous to her equilibrium. Nora, he said, I know I have no right to ask anything of you. I know what you survived, and I know that I am part of what caused it, regardless of what I intended. But I am asking you not to disappear again. He paused. Whatever this becomes, whatever you decide, let me know them. Let me begin to answer for what was lost. Outside, the bells of Crestholm had gone quiet. The wedding, Nora understood, was over in all but formal declaration. She looked at the man in front of her. The Alpha King of Ashenvale, the most powerful shifter in 4 territories, standing in a borrowed council room in a border village, asking her for something with no authority behind it at all. Just the asking. She did not say yes. She was not ready to say yes. But she did not say no. They gave her a room in the council hall. She had not agreed to stay. She had simply not left, which was a different thing entirely, and she was careful to maintain that distinction in her own mind. She was not staying because he had asked. She was staying because Oliver had fallen asleep in the chair by the fire before she could gather herself to leave. And moving him meant waking him. And waking Oliver when he had finally surrendered to sleep was a task she avoided on principle. She was staying because Seth had pressed his face into her shoulder and refused to release the fabric of her cloak, and because Ilara had discovered a basket of dried apples on the council table and was eating them with quiet, methodical satisfaction, and because the hour had grown late and the roads out of Crestholm were unlit after dark. She was staying because the walls were already down, and she needed time to decide what to build in their place. The room they brought her to was on the upper floor, simple, stone-walled, with a wide bed and a trundle beside it and a fireplace that the attendant lit without being asked. Clean linen, a pitcher of water, a small table with two candles. It smelled of beeswax and dried lavender, and Nora stood in the doorway for a moment, taking in the careful ordinariness of it, before she understood that someone had prepared this room in advance, before she had agreed to anything. She thought about that for a moment. Then she decided not to think about it anymore and put the children to bed. Ilara was asleep within minutes, curled on her side with her braid coming undone. Seth slept with his arms flung wide, taking up considerable space for someone so small. Oliver lay on his back and stared at the ceiling in the particular way he had when his mind was still working. "Who was that man?" he asked. Nora, sitting on the edge of the bed, kept her voice even. "Someone I knew a long time ago."
"Before us?"
"Before you, yes." Oliver was quiet for a moment. "He looked at us a lot."
"He did."
"Why?" Nora considered her answer with the care it deserved. She had spent 3 years crafting honest responses to questions that could have used lies, because she had decided early on that her children would grow up knowing the difference between truth and convenience. "Because we surprised him," she said at last. "He didn't know about you." Oliver absorbed this. "Are you going to tell him more?"
"I don't know yet."
Another silence. Outside, the wind had picked up and was pushing against the shutters, and the candle on the table wavered. Nora reached over and tucked the blanket more firmly around Oliver's shoulders, and he let her, which meant he was more tired than he was letting on.
"Mama,"
he said very quietly.
"Yes."
"You don't have to be scared." She looked at him. This small, serious person who had somehow arrived in the world already carrying more wisdom than seemed fair. Her chest ached with something she had no word for.
"I know," she said.
"I don't think he's bad," Oliver said. Then his eyes closed, and within moments his breathing had deepened, and he was gone. Nora sat in the firelight for a long time after that. She did not sleep well. The room was warm, and the bed was good, and the children were safe, and none of that was enough to quiet the part of her mind that was already 3 steps ahead, calculating. In the early hours, when the fire had burned down to embers and the room was dim and still, she lay on her back and looked at the ceiling and let herself think about what she had spent 3 years refusing to think about. She had left Ashenvale the night she found the council's correspondence, a letter folded into the back of a trade ledger she had been asked to review for an administrative error, buried so deeply in the dry language of pack law and territorial agreements that whoever placed it there had clearly not expected it to be found by someone who actually read carefully. The letter detailed an arrangement between Ashenvale's senior council and the Seraphine family of the Eastern Reach, an arrangement that predated Nora's arrival, that had been quietly maintained throughout her time in Ashenvale, and that, according to the council's own notes, was intended to be formalized once the current political alliance had served its purpose. The current political alliance, that was what they had called her. The thing she had believed was her life. She had read the letter 3 times. Then she had sat on the floor of the records room for a long time, not moving, while the candle burned down around her. She had been 22. She had been, she realized now with the perspective of 3 years, very young in ways that had nothing to do with age, young in her capacity to imagine that the people around her could be so deliberately unkind. She had not known, that night, about the children. She had suspected, in the careful peripheral way, that one suspects something one isn't ready to confirm. She had confirmed it 2 weeks later, in the borrowed room above the cobbler's shop, with a healer she had paid in the last of her silver coins to examine her and then forget the examination. She had built everything that came after from that moment, from the floor of a stranger's room in an unfamiliar town, with nothing but the cloak on her back and the knowledge that she was going to have to be much stronger than she had ever been asked to be before. She had done it. That was the thing she came back to, in the quiet hours. She had done it. She had built a life. It was small and unglamorous, and it smelled perpetually of bread and caraway seeds, and she loved it with a fierceness that sometimes surprised her. She was not going to let anyone dismantle it. Not even him. Not even if he had spent 3 years looking. In the morning, he came to find her. She had the children at the small table near the window, working through a breakfast of porridge and dried fruit that a kitchen boy had delivered without being asked. She was braiding Alara's hair, a task that required more concentration than it appeared, when the knock came. She knew it was him before she opened the door. She could not have said how. He was not in ceremonial armor today. A dark wool tunic, leather bracers, boots still carrying the dust of travel. He looked less like the Alpha King, and more like the man she had once thought she was beginning to know, which was in some ways more difficult to manage. He was carrying something. A wooden box, medium-sized, the kind used for document transport. He held it with both hands, and she noticed that his knuckles were slightly tight around it. "I need to show you something," he said. She stepped back from the doorway. He entered, registered the children at the table with a careful stillness, and set the box on the surface near the door. He did not immediately open it. Instead, he looked at Oliver, who was looking back at him with unabashed directness. "Good morning," Aiden said. Oliver considered him. "Good morning," he replied, with the seriousness of a small judge reserving verdict. Alara, whose social instincts were considerably less cautious than her brother's, said, "There's porridge," in a tone of generous invitation. "Thank you," Aiden said. Something moved briefly across his face. Not quite a smile, but adjacent to one. Nora finished Alara's braid, and tied it, and straightened. "What is in the box?" He opened it. Inside were documents, letters, official correspondence, sealed records bearing the wax stamps of Ashenvale's council. He removed them carefully and laid them on the table in front of her, away from the children's breakfast. "3 years ago," he said quietly, "I dissolved the agreement with the Seraphine family within 3 weeks of discovering it. These are the formal dissolution records." He indicated a thick folded document. "These," a bundle of letters, "are the correspondence I sent to my council regarding the three advisors who had entered that agreement without my sanction. Two were removed from their positions. The third was formally censured and stripped of his territorial appointments." He paused. "And this..." He set down the last item. A letter, older than the others, the paper slightly yellowed at the edges. "Is the search record. Every contact, every territory surveyed, every lead that led nowhere. 3 years of it." Nora looked at the documents. She did not touch them. "Why are you showing me this now?" she asked. "Because you left believing something that wasn't true. And I need you to know that, regardless of whatever else you decide." He met her gaze steadily. "I am not asking you to forgive a situation you were put in without your knowledge or consent. I am not asking you to overlook the fact that you spent 3 years alone raising three children who should have had more than one parent. I know what that cost. I cannot repay it." He glanced at the children briefly, then back at her. "But I will not have you believe I knew and chose otherwise. I couldn't bear that." The last sentence was very quiet, not performed, just honest. Nora looked at the search record. The pages were dense with notations, dates, locations, descriptions, dead ends. She could see, even without reading closely, the accumulated weight of it. 3 years of looking, documented in ink and parchment. She thought about what it meant. She thought about what it didn't mean. "Even if everything you're saying is true," she said carefully, "what happens now? You were to be married yesterday. You stopped a formal alliance ceremony. Every Pact Council in the region is going to treat that as a political rupture. You have obligations. The woman in that carriage is Lady Isolde Fenn," he said. "She is 26 years old, politically shrewd, and was no more pleased about the arrangement than I was. We have spoken this morning. She has agreed to a formal withdrawal. Her family will be compensated for the disruption through trade agreements that benefit them considerably more than the marriage would have." He paused. "She also sends her regards and says, and I am quoting directly, that she hopes you are less easily manipulated by council advisors than she was. Despite everything, despite the weight of the mourning and the documents on the table, and the 3 years of careful walls now thoroughly dismantled, something in Nora's chest loosened slightly. Not enough to matter, but enough to notice." "She sounds sensible," Nora said. "She is, which is why she understood immediately." He looked at her. "There is no political obligation that supersedes what I owe you and what I owe them." Oliver had stopped eating and was watching Aiden with an expression Nora recognized, the expression he wore when he was deciding whether to trust something. Ilara had climbed down from her chair and was examining the wooden box with investigative interest. Seth, who had been silent through all of it, looked up from his porridge and pointed at Aiden. "Who are you?" he asked, with the bluntness available only to three-year-olds. Aiden was quiet for a moment. He looked at Nora, a brief, genuine question in his expression, asking permission, asking how much, asking where the line was. She looked back at him. Then she looked at Seth. "His name is Aiden," she said. "He is someone who is going to be part of our lives for a while." Seth considered this. "Okay," he said, and returned to his porridge. It was not forgiveness. It was not a beginning. It was something smaller and more careful. A door left open, barely, in a wall that had stood for 3 years. But it was real. And Nora had learned, in the hardest school available, that real things were worth more than perfect ones. The days that followed did not resolve themselves neatly. Nora had half expected pressure, the kind she associated with Ashenvale. With councils and protocols and the grinding machinery of pack politics that had a way of turning people into pieces on a board. She had braced for it the way one braces for cold water, tensing against the inevitable shock. It did not come. Aiden stayed in Crestholm. He sent his formal guard back to Ashenvale with dispatches. She did not ask what they contained, and he did not tell her yet, and kept only a small detail of four men who remained unobtrusive and mostly invisible. He took a room in the council hall's lower floor and made no demands on her time. He did not knock on her door uninvited. He did not send attendants with summons or suggestions or carefully worded requests that were actually instructions. He was simply present, available, careful in the way that large, powerful things sometimes are when they understand that carefulness is what the moment requires. Nora watched him the way she watched everything now, with the peripheral, patient attention of someone who had learned that danger rarely announces itself directly. What she observed unsettled her more than pressure would have. On the second morning, she came down to the courtyard with the children and found him already there, crouched at the base of the old stone well, engaged in some form of construction project with Oliver that appeared to involve two sticks, a length of twine, and a degree of engineering seriousness that both of them were applying with complete sincerity. She stopped at the courtyard entrance and watched without being seen. Oliver was explaining something, gesturing at the well's stone edge, and Aiden was listening with the full, focused attention he gave everything, not the performance of listening that adults often offered children, but actual attention, following the logic of what Oliver was saying, and asking genuine questions in response. She stood there longer than she meant to. On the third day, Seth discovered that Aiden could whistle in a way that produced sounds resembling various birds, and attached himself to this skill with the single-minded dedication of a three-year-old who has found something extraordinary. For most of that afternoon, Seth could be located by following the sound of attempted bird whistles, none successful, all enthusiastic, across whatever space he and Aiden happened to be occupying. Alara, characteristically, approached him with her own agenda entirely. She had decided, on the basis of some internal logic Nora could not fully trace, that Aiden needed to understand the correct names of all the herbs in Marta's garden, and had appointed herself his instructor. Aiden submitted to this with a gravity that suggested he was taking the curriculum seriously. Nora, who had anticipated many things, had not anticipated this. She had not anticipated how it would feel to watch her children move towards someone with the uncomplicated openness that children had before the world taught them to protect themselves. She had not anticipated the particular ache of it. Not jealousy, not quite, but something adjacent to grief. For the time that was already gone. For the 3 years of mournings in this courtyard that had belonged only to her. She did not let herself linger on it. There was too much else to think about. On the fourth day, he asked if they could walk. The children were with Marta. The old healer had developed a particular fondness for Alara, and had invited all three to help her sort her autumn herb stores, a task that mostly involved Alara asking questions at high speed, and Oliver organizing things into precise categories, and Seth eating dried rose hips when he thought no one was watching. The morning was cold and clear, the sky a pale winter blue above the village rooftops. Their breath came out in small clouds. Nora kept her cloak pulled close and her hands tucked into her sleeves, and they walked the lane behind the council hall in silence for a while before either of them spoke. "I need to tell you something," Aiden said, "about why the council made the agreement with the Seraphine family without my knowledge." Nora waited. "When you came to Ashen Vale," he said, "you came as part of a territorial alliance with your father's pack. Your father was Alpha of Vale territory. That land, that bloodline, it carried weight in the regional council. The three advisors who arranged the Seraphine agreement were doing so because there was a faction within Ashen Vale's council that did not want that alliance to become permanent." He paused. "They believed that if you and I consolidated, if the Vale bloodline merged formally with Ashen Vale, it would shift the territorial balance in ways that several of them had financial reasons to prevent." Nora turned this over slowly. "They were protecting their own interests." "Yes, and they knew I would not agree to their reasoning if they brought it to me directly. So they acted without me." He glanced at her. "What I did not know until recently, until a contact of mine in the Eastern Reach sent information 6 weeks ago, is that the faction did not stop there." Something in his voice made her look at him directly. "Your brother," he said. The word hit her like a step missing in a dark staircase, the sudden lurching loss of solid ground. She stopped walking. "Corwin," she said. Her voice came out careful and thin. "Yes." Aiden stopped beside her. "When you left Ashen Vale, your brother was already concerned. He had been living in Vale territory, maintaining your father's lands after his death. Within months of your disappearance, the same council faction began maneuvering against Vale territory. They argued that without you present, without the alliance, the territorial agreement was void. They applied pressure through legal channels, trade restrictions, border disputes." He paused. "8 months after you left, Corwin was taken into what was formally described as protective council custody. In practice, that meant Ashen Vale's eastern holding facility." Nora was very still. "He has been held there for over 2 years, Aiden said. "Not harmed, but confined. Used as leverage, I believe, against the possibility that you might one day return with a claim." "A claim," she repeated. "The children," he said quietly. "If they are formally recognized as my heirs, the Vael bloodline does not merely survive. It becomes part of the royal line. That territory, that name, those lands cannot be dissolved or absorbed. The faction understood this risk from the beginning. Corwin was insurance. Nora turned away from him. She walked 3 steps toward the stone wall at the lane's edge and put her hand against it, feeling the cold, rough surface under her palm. The wall was solid and real, and she pressed against it and breathed. Corwin. Her brother, who had taught her to read territorial maps when she was 9 years old. Who had stood at their father's grave with dry eyes because he had cried already in private and did not think grief should be performed. Who had written her 3 letters in the first weeks after she arrived in Ashenvale, careful and formal in the way he was when he was worried, asking without asking if she was well. She had not written back. She had been learning to be the person Ashenvale needed her to be. She had told herself she would write when she had something good to say. She had never written. 2 years, she said to the wall. Yes. You said you only found out 6 weeks ago. Yes. The moment I received that information, I began preparations to retrieve him. The same week, the announcement for the alliance ceremony was made public. That was a separate council obligation I was already committed to. But I had every intention of addressing Corwin's situation directly afterward. He came to stand a few feet behind her. And then I saw you through a window in a village square, and everything changed order. Nora pressed her palm harder against the stone. The cold of it moved up through her wrist. I want him out, she said. I know. Not as part of any arrangement or condition or political negotiation. I want him out because he should never have been put in. She turned to face him. Can you do that? I have already sent the orders, he said. He will be released and brought here within the week. She studied his face, looking for the calculation behind it, the leverage, the favor being constructed. She found none of those things. She found only the steady, unperformed quality that she had always associated with him. The quality that had confused her in Ashenvale, because she had been looking for the angle and there hadn't been one, and she had eventually decided she must be missing something. Maybe she had been wrong. Maybe sometimes a thing was simply as it appeared. She was not ready to believe that fully, but she filed it away. The faction, she said. The 3 advisors. 2 removed, 1 censured. You said that. Yes. That isn't enough. He looked at her steadily. No, it isn't. He said it without qualification. What they did to you, what they arranged, what they allowed to happen to your brother. Removal from position is not sufficient. I know that. What are you prepared to do? Whatever the law allows. And I will ensure the law has room. He held her gaze. But I want you involved in that. I want you to hear the evidence, to understand what was done and by whom, and to have a voice in what justice looks like. This is not something I intend to do for you. I intend to do it with you. Nora thought of the 3 years she had spent in this village, in her bread-smelling kitchen, her quiet mornings, her children around the table. She thought of the life she had built from nothing, from rubble, from the cold floor of a stranger's room. She thought of Corwin in a holding facility for 2 years, waiting. Something shifted in her chest, not the cautious softening of the last few days, but something older and harder, something that had been dormant. She knew what it was. She had not let herself feel it in 3 years, because feeling it required believing she had somewhere to direct it. Anger. The clean, clarifying kind. The kind that did not consume. It illuminated. I want to see the evidence myself, she said. It will be ready for you this afternoon. I want to understand every decision that was made, every name attached to it. Yes. And I want to be present when they answer for it, not informed afterward. Present. He didn't hesitate. You will be. Nora looked at him for a long moment. The lane was quiet around them, cold and still, the winter sun doing very little about the temperature. "Oliver asked me this morning," she said, "if you were going to stay." A pause. "What did you tell him?"
"I told him I didn't know yet."
She looked at him steadily.
"That is still true.
I am not making decisions about the future based on what you did in the last 4 days, or what you're promising about Corwin, or what you showed me in that box of documents. 3 years cannot be answered in a week."
"I know.
But I am not leaving either. Not yet." She pulled her cloak tighter against the cold. "There is work to do first. There are people who owe a debt that hasn't been collected, and my brother needs to come home." She held his gaze. "After that, we will talk about everything else." Aiden looked at her with that particular quality of attention, the kind that had always made her feel, for better or worse, thoroughly seen. "After that," he agreed. It was not a resolution. It was not a beginning. It was a direction, which was more than she had allowed herself in 3 years, and it was enough. For now, it was enough. Corwin arrived on the 6th day. Nora heard the horses in the courtyard before she reached the window, and by the time she was down the stairs and through the side door, he was already dismounting. Thinner than she remembered, his dark coat travel-worn, his face carrying the particular stillness of someone who had learned to conserve expression over a long period of confinement. But he was standing. He was upright. He turned when he heard the door, and saw her. And something in his face broke open in the quiet, private way that Corwin had always broken. Without drama, without sound, just the sudden transparency of it. She crossed the courtyard, and he caught her by the shoulders, and they stood like that for a moment, not speaking, while the horses shifted and the cold air moved around them. "You're all right," he said finally. It was not a question. "I'm all right," she confirmed. He pulled back and looked at her face with the methodical attention of an older brother conducting an inventory. Then his gaze moved past her to the doorway, where Oliver stood watching with his arms crossed in a posture that was, she realized with a start, almost exactly the posture Corwin himself used when he was assessing a situation. Corwin went very still. Alara appeared at Oliver's elbow. Then Seth pushed between them and stared at the new arrival with frank curiosity. 3, Corwin said quietly. 3, Nora confirmed. He looked at her again. She saw him take in the full weight of it, the 3 years she had spent alone, the life she had built, the children who had grown without any of the people who should have known them. She saw him arrive at the edges of what he wanted to say and choose, as Corwin always did, the most essential thing. "I'm sorry I wasn't there," he said. "You were held against your will for 2 years," she said. "Don't apologize for that." "I'm apologizing for before that." His jaw was tight. "I should have gone to you. After the first letter I didn't get back, I should have come. We both should have done things differently." She took his arm. "Come inside. Meet them properly. They've been asking questions since I told them their uncle was coming, and Oliver's questions are very thorough, and you should prepare yourself." A sound that was almost a laugh moved through him. "Noted." The week that followed was the strangest of Nora's life, and her life had contained significant competition for that title. Corwin and Aiden occupied the same spaces with the careful wariness of two large animals who had not decided yet whether the other was a threat. They were unfailingly civil. They did not avoid each other. But every conversation between them carried the weight of everything that had happened. Corwin's 2 years in the holding facility, the council's manipulation, the 3 years Nora had spent in hiding. And that weight was present in the room, even when no one named it. On the 3rd day of Corwin's arrival, Nora walked into the council chamber and found them both bent over the table spread with documents, arguing in low voices about the precise legal mechanism for prosecuting former council members under PAC law. They were, she realized,
in complete agreement about the desired outcome, and were debating the methodology with the focused intensity of two people who both cared very much about getting it right. She stood in the doorway and watched them for a moment. Then she went back to the corridor and sat with the feeling for a while. The formal proceedings happened at the end of that second week. Aiden had sent for the three former council members, Aldrich, Payne, and Sorrell. Names Nora had learned by heart from the documents in that wooden box, and had them brought to Crestholm under guard escort. The council chamber was arranged formally for the occasion, the long tables set with the territorial seals and the official record keeper positioned at the corner with parchment and ink. Nora sat at the table, not behind Aiden, not to the side, in the position of a witness or a person being considered. At the table, with the documents she had spent 10 days reviewing spread before her, and Corwin at her left, and an empty chair at her right, where Aiden sat when the proceedings opened. When the three men were brought in, Aldrich, the senior of them, gray-bearded, accustomed to the performance of authority, looked at Nora with undisguised contempt. She had seen that look before. She had been 22 when she first encountered it, in the corridors of Ashenvale's stronghold, and she had read it correctly even then. The look that said, "You don't belong here. You are a convenience. You are a piece being moved across a board, and you should know your place." She let him look. Then she opened the first document and began. She had prepared carefully. Not with rage. Rage made you imprecise, and she needed to be precise. She had prepared with the cold, focused clarity of someone who understood exactly what had been done and to whom and why, and who had spent 10 days making certain that understanding was airtight. She laid out the correspondence. She named the dates. She connected the decisions to the consequences in a sequence so clean and documented that the record keeper's pen could barely keep pace. Aldrich attempted, twice, to redirect the proceedings toward procedural objections. Aiden, who had said almost nothing, dismantled both attempts in 2 sentences each, without raising his voice. Payne said very little. Sorrell, the youngest of the three, began to speak in his own defense midway through, and was silenced by Nora's quiet, "I have the letter. In your handwriting. Dated the 14th. Would you like me to read it aloud?" He would not. By the time she finished, the chamber was very quiet. The formal ruling came from Aiden as Alpha King, but he had made it clear in advance, clearly enough that even the record keeper knew, that the terms had been shaped by Nora's account, Nora's documentation, and Nora's stated position on what justice required. Aldrich, Payne, and Sorrell were formally stripped of all remaining titles, territorial appointments, and council privileges. Their assets connected to Ashenvale's administrative structures were seized and redirected. A portion to the restoration of Vale Territory's trade agreements, which had been deliberately damaged during their faction's campaign. They were permanently barred from any advisory role in any PAC council in the 4 territories. And the formal record of their actions, every letter, every decision, every manipulation, was to be copied and distributed to each of the regional councils, so that the accounting was public and permanent. It would not undo 3 years. It would not undo 2. But it was real, and it was documented, and it was done. When the three men were escorted out, Nora sat still for a moment in the quiet chamber. The candles on the table had burned low. Outside, the afternoon had turned gray, and she could hear the wind beginning against the shutters. Corwin put his hand briefly on the table beside hers, not touching, just present. She understood what it meant. Aiden beside her said nothing. He simply stayed. That evening, after the children were asleep, and Corwin had retired to his room with a book he'd found in the council hall's small library, Nora sat alone near the fire in the upper room, and let herself be still for the first time in what felt like years. Not the performing stillness she had mastered over 3 years. The stillness of someone managing, containing, maintaining. Actual stillness. The kind that came after something was finished,
She heard the knock at the door and knew it was him.
"Come in," she said. He entered and stood near the door, not presuming the chair, not filling the room with his presence the way he could have. He looked at her in the firelight and she looked at him, and for a moment neither of them said anything, and the silence was not uncomfortable.
"How do you feel?" he asked.
She considered the question honestly.
"Like something very heavy has been put down," she said, "and I'm still learning how to stand without the weight."
He nodded slowly.
"I owe you an answer," she said, "about what happens next."
"You don't owe me anything."
"I know I don't. That isn't why I'm doing it."
She looked at the fire for a moment.
"I spent 3 years building walls because I had to. Because walls were the only thing standing between my children and a situation I couldn't control.
I don't regret them."
She paused. "But I am also very tired of living inside them."
He waited.
"I am not the same person who came to Ashenvale at 22, she said. "I want to be clear about that. Whatever we build from here, if we build anything, it will not look like what we had before. I will not be managed or arranged or kept at a distance from decisions that affect my life and my children's lives. I will have my own place at the table, not a seat assigned to me."
"Yes," he said, simply, without qualification.
"And Corwin comes with us. Whatever home we make, he is part of it. Vile territory is restored, not as a political gesture, but as his right and the children's inheritance."
"Already in the formal record," he said, "the restoration order was included in today's ruling."
She looked at him. "You did that before I asked."
"I did it because it was right."
He met her gaze. "Not as a negotiation."
The fire crackled.
Somewhere below, the building settled in the way old stone buildings did at night, a low, deep sound like a slow breath. Nora thought of Oliver at the well with his engineering project, of Seth's determined, fruitless bird whistling, of Alara conducting her herb lessons with absolute authority, of Corwin across the courtyard, breaking open quietly without a sound. She thought of herself, 22 years old, on the floor of a stranger's room, deciding to survive. She had done more than survive.
"All right," she said.
It was not a dramatic declaration. It did not need to be. It was simply the truth, spoken plainly, in a firelit room at the end of a very long road. He crossed the room and sat in the chair across from her. Not beside her. Not closer than invited. Just present. And they stayed like that for a while, watching the fire, letting the quiet settle around them like something earned. In the months that followed, Crestholm saw the last of them. They returned to Ashenvale in early spring, not with a procession, not with ceremony, but in a convoy of 3 carriages carrying a healer's supply of herbs, an assortment of children's wooden toys, a crate of books Corwin had acquired, and 1 extremely opinionated cat that Alara had adopted from the council hall courtyard and refused to leave behind. The cat was named Chancellor, a choice Oliver had proposed in complete seriousness that no one had been able to argue against. Ashenvale's stronghold was different than Nora remembered it. Or perhaps she was different. The corridors that had once felt like a maze designed to disorient her were simply corridors now, stone and torchlight, and the smell of beeswax polish and old wood. The great hall where she had once stood uncertain of her footing was simply a room with very high ceilings. She walked through it with the children beside her and Corwin at her shoulder, and she did not feel like a visitor. The council that gathered to receive them was newly composed. Aiden had spent the months of her decision reshaping it, a process she had been consulted on and had contributed to, and the faces around that table were different from the ones she remembered. Younger, some of them. More varied in their territorial origins. One was a woman, a senior healer from the Northern Territory, whose reputation for fair judgment was apparently formidable. Nora sat at the council table, not to the side, not in an advisory position. At the table,
with the formal acknowledgement of her role, not merely as the mother of the Alpha King's children, but as the recognized Luna of Ashenvale, a title that carried weight in Packlaw, and that she had accepted on her own terms, after reading every document that defined what it meant, and striking through the parts she disagreed with, and replacing them with language that she and Aiden had negotiated over 3 careful weeks. The council had approved it. Oliver, at his first formal meal in the Great Hall, sat very straight and observed everything with grave attention and ate his meal with perfect composure, and then, when the formal part of the evening was concluded, went directly to find Aiden and report his assessment of each council member in turn. Aiden listened to all of it with complete seriousness. Nora, who was watching from across the room, thought that whatever she had been afraid of, it had not been this. Seth learned, within the first week, that the Stronghold's kitchen staff would give him things if he whistled at them. This created a brief diplomatic incident with the head cook that Nora resolved by explaining Seth's charm offensive with an apology and a genuine compliment about the bread, which was very good. Alara immediately identified the Stronghold's overgrown inner garden as a problem requiring her attention and began composing a restoration plan with the help of the groundskeeper, who was 70 years old and delighted. Corwin was given formal stewardship of Vial territory. His right, always his right, now restored in law as well as in truth. He rode there in the first week of summer, and Nora stood in the courtyard and watched him go with a feeling she had not expected. Relief. Not because she wanted him gone, but because watching him ride toward something that was his again. The land, the sky, the quiet authority of home, felt like the last piece of something being returned to its correct place. He came back, of course. He was family. He always came back. On a morning in late summer, Nora stood in the Stronghold's library with a cup of tea going cold in her hand and a territorial map spread on the table before her. The window was open behind her, and the air smelled of pine and warm stone, and very faintly, the lavender from Alara's newly rehabilitated garden below. She heard small footsteps in the corridor, Seth's particular rhythm, which was always slightly off-tempo in a way that was entirely his own. He pushed open the library door and found her at the table. "Mama," he said. "Oliver says I can't name my wolf Chancellor because the cat is already Chancellor and it would be confusing." Nora considered this. Oliver has a point. Seth's expression indicated that he was registering this information while reserving the right to disagree later. "Can I have a different name for it?" "You can have any name you like." He thought about it with great concentration. "Admiral," he said finally. "That is an excellent name." Satisfied, he departed. Nora looked back at the map. The borders of Ashenvale's territory and Vial territory beside it, and the 4 surrounding regions, all of it legible to her now in a way it had not been when she was 22 and learning. She had spent the spring learning it properly. She had opinions about the eastern border dispute. She had expressed them in council with documentation, and they had been taken seriously. She heard another set of footsteps, heavier, measured, and did not turn around. "Seth has named his wolf Admiral," she said. "I heard." Aiden came to stand beside her at the table. He looked at the map. "The eastern boundary." "The eastern boundary," she confirmed. "The survey from last autumn is incomplete. If we're renegotiating the trade terms with the Fenwick Pack, we need accurate current measurements, not 3-year-old estimates." "I'll send a survey team this week. I'll go with them." He looked at her. She looked back at him, and something in his expression, that familiar quality of attention, steady and unhurried, settled into something that she now recognized for what it was. Not management, not arrangement, not the careful diplomacy of 2 people negotiating a shared space. Just this. Just the ordinary, extraordinary fact of being known by someone who had chosen to know her and choosing to know them in return. "All right," he said. She looked back at the map. Outside, in the garden below, she could hear Alara explaining something to the groundskeeper, in a tone of absolute authority. She could hear Oliver's voice somewhere farther off, precise and considered, asking a question she couldn't quite catch. She could hear Chancellor the Cat conducting some investigation in the corridor that involved a great deal of movement. The stronghold was loud with it, with all of them, the noise of a life that was fully occupied and still growing. Nora picked up her tea. It was cold now, but she drank it anyway. She had learned. Somewhere in the long, hard road of the last 3 years, that warmth was not always the point. Sometimes the point was simply that the cup was yours, and you had made it, and you were still here to hold it. She was still here. All of them were. And that, in the end, was everything.